Mike Huckabee is a prominent and very respected Republican leader. He runs and he rocks. As a politician, he spent many years as governor of Arkansas, many months as a Republican presidential candidate, and who knows, possibly a vice presidential candidate. As a runner, he has finished several marathons. He dropped over 100 pounds doing it. And as a rocker, he lays down a mean baseline. And by the way, he's in town to do that. You can see former Governor Huckabee, along with our friend Yes drummer Alan White. It's part of a drive to bring music-themed license plates to the state of Washington. You buy your music-themed license plate, and the money goes to charity.
Like you'd see a Seattle Mariners plate or a Pearl Harbor Survivor plate. You could show your support for music, and all the money would go to schools.
All right. So, Mike Huckabee, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
And how did you hook up with these musicians?
They were intoxicated late one night, and somebody suggested that they hang out with me, and in a weak moment, they decided that they would.
That was thoughtful of them.
Yeah.
Your honesty is enlightening. Crippling.
I think after about 12 cups of some serious Starbucks this morning, they'll change their mind and we'll probably call the show off.
Mike, I wanted to ask you something. Have you written books?
I've written five books.
Five books, that's what
Working on the sixth one that comes out in November of this year.
Is your sixth book aimed at Hillary Clinton and called How to Lose Gracefully?
No.
It's
coming out in November, and she will have not given up by November. In fact, she's going to go to the inauguration waving a flag saying, it really should be me. It really should be me.
I saw you on the news channels, and I have to say it was interesting. You know, we all know politics is an interesting game because you want people to say exactly what it really is, but when you're a politician, you're being cornered constantly by people trying to make, like, wouldn't it be better for the party if you got out and stuff like that?
Yeah.
And when you were in that position,
yeah,
you were graceful, you were respectful of your opponent, you were pretty graceful the whole time. Is that why you lost?
Yeah. That's why I'm playing the music jam tonight,
right,
and not campaigning somewhere. Okay, I think this is finished now.
No, I actually mean that kind of seriously, because some of us get jaded about politics, and it feels like in order to win, you have to be mean.
You know, I think it's interesting that the two Republicans that ran the most civil campaigns were the last two on their feet, John McCain and me. Neither one of us attacked each other. We didn't attack other candidates. We were the object of some attacks, but we didn't attack back. And I think it was very significant that both of us tried to run campaigns that said, this ought to be about what we're for, not what's wrong with somebody else. Mm. And I went into this whole process running for president saying, you know, if I have to take somebody's head off in order to be president, then, you know, it goes back to a simple principle. If you gain the whole world and lose your own soul, what does it profit you? And for me, that's a maxim that I try to live by, that it doesn't really matter even if it's the presidency, but if you did it by the loss of your own integrity and your own soul and your own sense of core, then you really haven't gained as much as you've lost.
Given that standard, can anybody win an election?
No, it's impossible.
No, it's impossible.
I think it is possible. And let me say this, obviously I'm a John McCain supporter at this point, and hope he wins and going to work very hard for him. But respectfully, Barack Obama has run, I think, a campaign that has tried to focus more on what he wants to do and who he's about. It's about his vision, and I respect him. I even applaud him for that, and I hope it can continue that both he and McCain, I know they're going to mix it up, and that's part of the process. But it hasn't been about personal attacks to each other, attacking their character and attacking their integrity and honesty and honor, and I do hope it continues.
When Hillary said the whites, the hardworking Americans, did that totally sink her?
It didn't help her, and I think it also showed that there was a level of desperation. But you know, I've known the Clintons a long time,
and they're not at all prejudiced, right?
They're I mean, one thing you can say. I mean, the Clintons,
she was just talking demographics. She just didn't, you know,
it was
think
a poor choice of words. And you know, I've had a few of those myself from time to time.
What's your worst gaffe?
Let's save that for next time.
Yeah. I think you're
deciding to come on this show.
I was going to say we only have a couple hours, so we don't have time to go.
So
through
that
them
happens
all.
To any politician. Do you actually feel sorry for another politician, even an opponent, when you see them in an uncomfortable situation, and you see the way the media are like piranha on
well,
that?
Well, if they're running against me, no, I'm happy to see them fall on their face. But, you know, I do have a real sympathy for the guys that are out there. People don't understand. You're getting 3 hours of sleep a night. You're making 10 speeches a day. You're being jostled about, you know, in crowds of people, literally just being grabbed and pushed and shoved. And your brain is just like scrambled eggs at some point. And then you get up and somebody asks you a question or you're in the middle of a speech. And you say something, it comes out, and the next thing you know, it's all over the national news.
Right.
And, you know, I always say, let's cut these folks some slack. If the whole body of their life and work is not, you know, indicative of what they've just said, then, you know, give them a little room here.
People are very upset by high gas prices right now.
I wonder why.
They're high. Congress holding hearings, you know, people with just a railing on the oil companies for record profits. You had Hillary all float the idea of a gas tax holiday.
As did McCain.
And McCain, did he also float
that? Yeah, he did.
And you had Obama and others saying, well, that's a parlor trick. It's not really going to help, and I thought it could actually increase consumption, which would be the worst thing. What is there some, like, neither way can work? We can't just regulate the oil industry and take that huge segment of the economy which people have invested in. It's in, you know, people's 401ks, even if they don't know it.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just totally drastically change our economy, or can you? Or is there some balance between regulation and free markets that will allow us to develop new energy? If you were president, what would your position on this have been?
Well, I would say that we would get energy independent in 10 years. The reason that we are in the mess we're in, not only in terms of energy cost and economic disaster, but also because of our military situation, the ties that we have in the Middle East, we're financing both sides of the war on terror. Our tax dollars pay for the military, but it's our oil dollars that finance the terrorists. And if we don't understand that, we're kidding ourselves. We've made the Saudis obscenely rich. We go to them and ask them to increase production to get us out of this sort of crisis, and they thumb their nose at us. And they just go ahead and continue to increase the obscenity of their wealth. And one of the things...
The oil companies say that they need these record profits to develop new sources of oil, but how do we make sure that's what they're actually using the record profits for?
Well, the best thing to do is to get to the decision that we're going to be weaned off of oil, and that we're not going to continue to use fossil fuels for the long-term future.
Do you live in a geodome right next to Al Gore somewhere where you've got a house that doesn't use any
energy?
Made
of old tires and mud. Yeah, the whole house.
I actually drive a flex fuel vehicle.
A flex fuel? What's that?
That's you can use E85 and other fuels in it.
Okay.
And,
gas or corn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can, you know, throw all sorts of old scraps from the table. And
Dr. Brown from the Back to the Future. Yeah, yeah. A beer can and a banana peel.
But and that's the other thing, the ethanol deal. It doesn't cost more to make ethanol than it actually saves us. Is it sort of like a subsidy for our farmers?
Well, there is a cost factor on ethanol, but the real issue is that the technology is developing and emerging, and it's getting better. I don't think ethanol is the single answer. I think that there ought to be a variety of energy sources that are alternative, domestically produced, environmentally friendly. It ought to be wind and solar, it ought to be hydrogen cells. We ought to be looking at a lot of things, and here's one of the things to do is to turn loose the technology and innovation in this country and to say whoever comes up with it, it's a tax-free approach. You go out there and develop it. We're not going to penalize you for being productive. In fact, the investors who get involved in these energy alternatives are
incentives,
going to get
wealthy. Incentives.
That's
to
exactly
develop.
Right.
That's
you it. Give people a reason to go out there and do it.
I have the answer, but it isn't without problems. You find a car that runs on tobacco.
Yeah.
But the only problem is you can't drive within 25 foot of a bar.
Oh.
So if you're willing to make that sacrifice.
By the way, the solar car won't do well here in Seattle. I don't know if you're outside today.
Yeah, you're going to see a lot of cars stalled on the side of the road.
Yeah. So were you sad when for a while there, it looked pretty good for you.
Yeah.
You looked like you might get... I can never understand what it was like. First off, I don't know why anybody would want to be president.
Yeah, I'm wondering that myself.
I mean, as soon as you're president, the cartoon people stretch and mangle your face and start drawing cartoons.
They don't even wait till you get there. They do it before you.
Right.
Yeah.
And they
it.
Want scandals. If they can't find them, they invent them. They will look at every business deal you ever did and look at whether you made greedy money or whether you did something untowards. It's weird. You've been under the microscope a lot.
You know, and that's part of politics. But if you love your country and you really believe you have some ideas that would help it be a better country, then you're willing to go through, you know, even the pain and the problems that you go through as a candidate. And I passionately love this country. I know where I came from. You know, I grew up in a household where I was the first male in my entire family lineage to even graduate high school. My mother had grown up in the Depression, oldest of seven kids, dirt floors, outdoor toilets. You know, I consider myself the most amazingly lucky man on earth.
Wait a minute.
To live in this
dirt
country.
Dirt floors, outdoor
toilets, no electricity when she was a little girl. And, you know, the poverty of the Deep South was intense. And so, you know, I'm one generation away from that.
So did she used to say to you, when I was your age?
Oh, listen, you know, I'm only 52 years old, but I lived through the Depression myself because I had to go through every bit of it through my parents who told me about walking to school, uphill both ways.
8 miles to school.
Snowing in July.
In the snow. Even though it never snowed in Arkansas, it snowed every day they went to school. Every day. Yep.
Eric?
Tough.
Oh, Eric looked like he wanted to follow up on that.
Oh, definitely. I don't know how much international travel you've done, Governor. But
about 41 countries. I've been all over the world.
Right, because we got back from Africa recently doing some work with World Vision to sponsor children over there. And it completely changes your perspective on how we as Americans fit into the rest of the world. What would you say to the average American about how easy we have it here?
And we're going to have to come back because we have to do a break first. How easy do we have it here? And Republican guys don't get a lot of credit for caring about the poor. So if you could juxtapose how you feel about the poor and how easy we have it here, we'll be back with Governor, ex-governor. You always called governor, though, right?
It's kind of like being a colonel, a general, or you know, a buck private. You always are.
Arkansas governor and former presidential candidate Mike Huckabee in just a moment.
There must be some kind of way out of here. Say the Joker to the thief.
Governor Mike Huckabee, you like Hendrix? You requested that.
I love
that.
Jimi Hendrix. Yes, I do. And one of the interesting things, one of the first times I did an interview on a rock radio station in Little Rock, they played Hendrix bumper music going into it. And I knew every song and they were shocked. They just knew that I was this straight-laced, you know, the kind of guy that had swallowed a curtain rod. My back was so straight and baptized in vinegar and very unhappy. And I said, no, I know all the songs. And I went through this whole deal. But I'm a big Hendrix fan, and obviously when you come to Seattle, it's kind of got to, you know, pay tribute somewhere.
Hey, Eric, go ahead and follow up. Repeat your question again for Mike Huckabee.
Absolutely. Governor, you've traveled to 41 countries, and we've traveled to several ourselves. What do you say to Americans to give them some sort of perspective on how easy we have it in relation to the rest of the world?
You know, the poorest person in America lives better than about 90% of the world's population. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't care and have a lot of compassion for people who are poor in this country, because relatively speaking, poverty is poverty. Doesn't matter where it is. But this is an amazing place. I'll give you a little story. I was in a car the other day that Meet the Press had sent to pick me up to do the interview. And so the driver and I were talking. He's been in America 7 years. He came here from Africa. And he came here, didn't know a word of English. He washed dishes and worked in the kitchen at McDonald's and then worked his way up, and one thing led to another. Now he owns his own business. And in 7 years, he's gone from not knowing a word to speaking very fluent. And he was asking me all these questions about English words. And he was saying, you know, in this country, a person can do anything if you're willing to work hard. And it's just so refreshing to hear somebody who loved America more than most of us who were born here. And he lived the dream that so many people forget is still possible. I tell people I'm living the American dream, and I have lived it. I know where I've come from, and I understand, you know, if you grow up where you live in a little bitty town in the Deep South, and, you know, you don't think you'll ever see anything but three blocks away from you, and one day to run for president of the United States, you know, what a country.
Now, myths about Republicans include...
Okay.
Don't care about the poor.
Oh, they don't. No, I'm kidding. I mean,
love big business in the pocket.
Soundbite.
Love big business.
Soundbite.
Oh, that'll be on YouTube.
Be
I can
that
see that one
there.
No, you know, I think there's a lot of myths. For example, that we don't care about the poor, and you know, I'm sure there's some Republicans who don't. But the reality is, the Democrats have more money this year than the Republicans do, and there are an incredible amount of extraordinarily filthy rich Democrats. I don't think politics is about income levels.
Let's see. Casey's got one for you.
Okay.
I don't think it's a myth, though.
Oh, what is this one?
Oh, okay. This is a good one.
Oh, okay.
This is a good one.
All right.
So my dream, my dream is about to become fulfilled. I'm going to be marrying my life partner.
Ah.
Now, I was wondering if that poses a problem, though, because I know I find you a really funny guy, and I like you a lot, but if I were to tell you I was marrying my life partner, I feel like maybe you wouldn't like me so much.
You know, I respect people who have different views. I believe marriage is traditional. I'm a traditionalist. And, you know, just like I'm probably not going to change your mind, you probably won't change mine. Doesn't mean that I don't like people. Doesn't mean that I hate people. Or doesn't mean that I don't respect people. I think people can have disagreements and have a very different approach and attitude toward other folks without having any sort of animosity toward them. But I do believe marriage is traditional. In every culture in the history of mankind, marriage has always meant man-woman relationship who create the next generation and then train their replacements. And I think when we change the rules, that's a serious thing. It's one thing to say people have a right to live with whoever they want. That's one thing. But when you redefine an institution, that's a different deal. And that's what really, I think, is happening in our culture. And I'm not comfortable with that because I think that it's a big, big issue when you redefine.
Are you comfortable with equal rights for partnerships where in terms of being treated as a couple, civil unions?
Well, yeah, I think people can have the capacity, and they do that through a power of attorney. There are a lot of different ways in which those things can be accomplished. But anything that approaches where you start encroaching upon the marital relationship, you know, I think that requires...
I just want cake, man. That's all I want is cake.
Well, by the way, I should also tell you that Casey is as straight as that curtain rod, which you didn't swallow. Just wanted to ask you that question. See how you looked at it.
There's a member of my family that I feel I love and very close to, and they can't get married, so speaking on her behalf.
Oh, okay.
That law just changed in California.
Yeah.
You know, the argument is that doesn't really hurt marriage because marriage is already difficult for people
that's exactly the point. You know, we've got a 50% failure rate with traditional marriage. It looks like we ought to be getting that one right before we start a new version of it.
Well, gays stay together forever, I think, would help our average.
Well, they really don't. They don't. The truth is they have a greater breakup rate.
Is it true?
Yeah, that is true.
Well, if you count bathrooms.
Oh, I'm not going there. You know, I may want to run for office again someday. I don't want it all to end in Seattle.
Did you count restrooms? I'm just curious. Now, a couple of other things. Now, other Republican myths? Anybody got one? Joe, you must have one.
Well, it's not so much a myth, but I want to say, Mike, I like you, I was born in Water Valley, Mississippi, a very small town. I had not dirt on the floor. We had floorboards, but my dad had dirt on the floor. Mm-hmm. My grandfather was a Democrat, and I've always voted Democrat. But when it got down to four people this year, you and Mr. McCain and Ms. Clinton and Mr. Obama, I said any of these four people would make a great leader, and I was really torn as to which one to choose. As a lifelong Democrat, what drew you to the Republican Party, and what would you say to a person who might consider voting Republican for the first time? Because I must say, we've spoken to your wife, Janet. We've spoken to Cindy McCain. You guys have made yourselves very available to us, whereas not so much with the other party.
There you go. That's it right there. You know,
Obama is too busy walking around with outstretched arms blessing things and feeding people with loaves and fishes.
Hillary's collecting her 30
pieces of silver. You're not going to touch that one either.
No, I'm not going to touch that one. In fact, you're doing a lot of stuff today. I'm not touching this stuff. I grew up like most kids in the Deep South in a hardcore Democrat family. There were three great heroes in every household in the Deep South. Elvis, Jesus, and FDR, not necessarily in that order.
Yeah, well done.
And the truth is, you know, it was a tough thing for me to become a Republican, which I did as a teenager, but here was the reason. Because I really believe, first of all, in individual empowerment. I did not believe that I should be held back in my life, that I had to sort of be categorized as part of a group, that it was my demographic that either led me forward or kept me back. So the idea of individual empowerment, individual responsibility was part of it. I also believe that the best government is the most local government, not a centralized federal government, that we ought to do things more locally, less federally. I believe in lower taxes, not higher taxes, to the degree that can be accomplished, because if you go out and earn money, you ought to spend it, not somebody reaching into your pocket and spending it for you. I believe also that the less regulation we have, the more free market we have, the better the economy works. When you manipulate the marketplace with a lot of government interference, what you end up doing is you empower the people who are doing the regulating as opposed to empower the consumers who really ought to be managing that marketplace. There are a lot of other reasons. One of them is I'm pro-life. I believe very strongly that the founding fathers, when they said that all of us are created equal, if you think about the implication of that, it means that everybody has intrinsic worth. It doesn't matter whether you have Down syndrome. It doesn't matter whether you are severely disabled, whether you're in the womb or whether you're in a bed and you're terminally ill. We ought to respect you as a human being and respect your life. And because of that deep embrace that I have for the sanctity of every human life, of its intrinsic worth and value, it kind of left me without many choices in terms of a political home.
Yet you rock out to Jimi Hendrix.
Absolutely.
With all those beliefs.
You know, some of the
that's the myth about Republicans, I guess, is that you are humorless and no fun. I mean, yet you seem kind of fun.
You're proving us wrong.
You know, that really hurts.
Well, right? No, I mean, that's, wow. I said the myth.
No, you know, here's the thing I find. And again, this is a generalization, not always true. There's some funny liberals, but I find that liberals are the most sensitive people on earth. Everything offends them. Everything requires you to apologize all over your face for. Look, life is too short for us to get just too politically correct where we're getting all this sensitivity. We ought to lighten up, make fun of ourselves, and live life with a little bit of levity. And that's something I think that folks on the far left sometimes miss.
All right, last question.
Okay.
You're pushing real hard to be vice president, right?
No, really, I'm not.
No. You'd like to be vice president.
There was an old song by the Seeds called Pushing Too Hard.
If asked, you would be vice president.
Of this radio station? No problem.
We're going down in flames.
We can use
one.
Yeah.
Why does no one want to answer that question?
Well, it's really kind of unbecoming to say, hey, here am I. I'd like for you. Because it's John McCain's decision. I'm going to respect whoever he picks. And, you know, if you start needling for the job, it looks like you're just kind of bad for.
Right. I did hear you say that if it were offered to you, you wouldn't have to ever apologize.
That's what I said. And
the press campaigned on.
Yeah, and then the press said that I was asking for the job. Right. I said, no, I have nothing to live down. I never said anything about John McCain that I'd have to go back and explain. Say, well, I didn't really mean it then, which I have a problem with because.
That's the trickiest thing about being a politician, by the way, and especially now in the YouTube generation, is that every word you say 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, can be used as if it was testimony.
And it will be. You bet it will.
Well, Mrs. Clinton has already offered the position to Obama, but if she would offer it to you...
Hey, there is a greater likelihood that she will dye her hair green, get tattoos and piercings, and go on tour with Amy Winehouse.
After swallowing the curtain rod.
If she'd get her the freak job vote, she'd go there.
She might go there. Right.
Now, you did something phenomenal while you were the governor of Arkansas, and not a lot of people know about it, but it has to do with why you're here today, and why you're here with these incredible musicians. Alan White is here.
Dr. Bob.
Wreak
Havoc.
Of Havoc. Wreak Havoc. Is that your real name?
That's a real name.
Come on. Mm-hmm. Come on.
Yeah, well, it's my legal name. I sort of have an image to live down to. But
Okay. And Dr. Bob, Tom Berg, that's you, Dr. Bob, in the striped shirt,
me.
Right? Okay, from Music Aid Northwest. What is Music Aid Northwest? And then I want Mike to tell the story from Arkansas.
Music Aid Northwest is a group that started. Alan White helped us begin when we had all the natural disasters of a few years ago that are still going on. We all decided to form a 501c3 charity and put on concerts to help the people, the victims of those disasters. And now we've decided we want a sustainable kind of contribution to society. And so we're trying to have a specialty license plate, like you see the Husky license plates and the Cougar license plates, that we can get the proceeds from the sale of that license plate and give it back to the school districts that purchase the license plates. So instead of selling magazines, perhaps, in the high schools, they can sell license plates, and then the money will actually go back in a major percentage to the people that bought them to have a perpetual...
And school music programs, like, they're the first thing that those evil Republicans cut, right? I mean,
Republican myth.
They're the first thing that gets cut when times are tough. Schools are locally funded, right? For the most part, that stuff, the state government cuts that stuff. Who cut our music and gym programs?
Well, for the most part, each state has it differently. In Arkansas, the state has the ultimate responsibility, but it's a shared local state of deal. And you know, when I was governor, one of the things that I felt very passionate about. When you cut music and art programs out of a school, what you've done is you've ruined the school. Because we are created to have the right side of our brain function as much as the left side.
Creatively.
The creative side. And if you take music and art programs out of a student's curriculum, you end up with what we have, a 6,000 kids a day in America dropping out of school. And they're dropping out because they're bored. Not because they're dumb. They're bored. They're bored to death. I was one of the first governors in America. We were one of the first states that mandates music and art education for every student, K through 12, every single week.
It's Arkansas, so does it have to be bluegrass, or can you do a different kind of music?
Boom! Oh!
And okay. Being friends with Alan, I know if you hadn't taken piano lessons as a kid, you wouldn't be playing music for...
You took piano lessons, Al?
Well, from the age six, yeah.
Age six.
I played piano before drums.
Oh. I had music in school.
I had the teacher wrap my knuckles with a ruler, you know, when I got one note wrong.
All right.
But maybe this is you're paying back here somehow, too.
Did you, where did you pick up the bass?
When I was 11 years old, I got my first guitar. It was a J.C. Penney mail order guitar my parents paid $99 for. It took them a year to pay for it. A year to pay $99.
To pay for your bass.
But I wanted to be in a rock band. That's what I wanted to do in my whole life. And so, you know, I played that thing till my fingers nearly bled. And, you know, music became an important part of my life. But it also gave me a sense of confidence. I was a shy, bashful little kid. Obviously, I've gotten over that.
Gotten over the shy thing, yeah.
But I wouldn't have had it not been for music and the later drama, working in the theater and debate. You know, whether it's Alan White or it's me or anybody else, I'll tell you, music will change a kid's life. And not just music. It might be dance. It might be theater. It might be, the visual arts. But the point is, every child has an innate sense of artistic capacity. I was saying to some of our folks earlier, take a child when he's 5 years old. You don't have to beg him to sing. You have to tell him to quit. You don't have to ask him to draw a picture. You have to tell him it's time to eat dinner. What happens when that same kid's 15? You can't get him to draw. You can't get him to sing. Why? Because the crazy educational system in this country has beat the ever-living creativity out of him. And that's wrong, and it's the reason our educational system's in the toilet today.
Yeah, hasn't it been proven, though, that kids that do pick up an instrument do better academically?
Absolutely.
Science and math, absolutely.
They'll do 10 points better on the SAT in math. They will learn language better. They will do science, everything. And part of it is simple. They learn how to learn. But the other part is, if you stimulate the cognitive side of your brain, you're going to see that there's dramatic improved capacities for learning. And so, if you really want to improve math and science and language scores, don't cut music, increase it. You'll actually see the direct benefit from that.
What a great guy, Mike Huckabee.
Would you run for president?
No.
Well, really?
It's a dead-end deal. I've been there, done that, have a lot of T-shirts to prove it, too.
I do have one request of you before you leave, though, if everybody else could be quiet. Could you just say this for me? Hi, this is Vice President Huckabee, and you're listening to the Bob Rivers Show. I just want to have it in case.
Yeah, you're right. You know, if I said that, that's going to end up going all over the network. Huckabee is so blatant in his ambition that he's actually calling himself.
You won't even say it so we can edit it down later, will you?
No.
Can you just say,
hi,
this is Mike Huckabee. I am against Vice.
Yeah.
If I were ever president someday. That'd be good. You've been really fun to be with. I've seen you on the comedy shows. You're one of the easiest going presidential candidates out there. It's a shame. It's like, you know, you get to know someone and you know how nice they are, but during the heat of the campaign, it's just battle, battle, battle.
Well, yeah, that's one of the frustrations of a campaign. The debates were really more like game shows than they were debates. It was very frustrating. And I think that it's important that people get to know candidates, not because they have an assumption, oh, he's a Republican, so therefore people say, I know all about him. Do they really? Or he's a Democrat, I know everything I need to know about him. Maybe not. And I really do believe that that's one of the unfortunate things of politics is we get to stereotyping people.
Well, they ask like you're supposed to give it a 3-second soundbite. Answers to complex.
No, we were looking for flat tax or flat worm.
The thing that got me, you know, like you do these debates, and the question would be a minute and a half that the host was at. Now, if Iran were to attack Iraq, and if Russia were to come, and they go through this long scenario and said, now, you have 30 seconds, what would you do? I'd say I'd just push the button and be done with it. Why not?
Hallelujah.
Mike Huckabee, thank you very much for all you're doing for music education, all of the information about this amazing jam session, which is tonight at the Old Redmond Firehouse Teen Center at 7 o'clock. We'll be on our website, bobrivers.com. All the best.
Thank you.
Hey, Joe, where you going with that gun of yours?
There is never a second that goes by in the day when Hal Blaine is not being played on the radio somewhere. Who is Hal Blaine? The most prolific drummer in recorded music history. He has played on 150 top 10 records, 40 number ones, 8 songs that won the Grammy for Record of the Year, literally thousands more on albums you own. Who did he play with? Elvis, Sinatra, the Beach Boys, Simon and Garfunkel, Herb Albert, the Mamas and the Papas, Fifth Dimension. Dozens of others feature Hal laying down the beat. He was part of a legendary group of studio musicians that used to be known as the Wrecking Crew. And he's the subject of a documentary with that same group. This, ladies and gentlemen, is music history and music present. I can't believe we've spoken to him on the phone. I can't believe we have the legend, the man himself, in the studio with us today. Hal Blaine, welcome to the Bob Rivers Show.
And I'm still alive.
Yeah. I apologize, sir. That was my doing a couple years ago. I started that ugly rumor.
What made you think he was gone?
Well, for one thing, it just doesn't...
easy, greasy. Come on.
Doesn't seem right a guy that's done as much as Mr. Blaine. I mean, I don't know where I heard that, but that was a bad deal.
And that happened to Tim Russert last week when some politician said, and, you know, if your dad... your dad is probably in heaven looking down on us now. It was a Big Russ, big boy, whatever his name was. And Russ was like, well, he's watching at home. He's eating a burger.
The first thing I have to say is my name is Hal. I can't stand Mr. Blaine.
Okay.
Well, I was defending this man left and right, Joe.
Well, this may offend you too, but I've got so many albums that you've played on. But the one I picked out, I didn't even realize you played on it until I was listening into my car with my daughter. It's one of our favorites, and it's David Grisman and Jerry Garcia, Not for Kids Only.
That's it.
And I bet with the 35,000 songs you recorded, this is the only one you played your belly on, because I know you played your belly on this. At least that's what they say in the liner notes.
I know I did, and I played on one other. There's a great singer in L.A. by the name of Lauren Hart, beautiful lady, and she's the granddaughter of one of the great silent film stars. And we were recording her album, and she did one song. It was kind of a laid back southern little thing, and I was going, and they loved it. They said, let's do that, and I did it on that.
Now, have you slapped anything worse on a record that we don't want a demonstration today?
I don't think so.
A woman, perhaps?
Perhaps a lawyer at times. But.
Hal Blaine. Hal, you are going to, in a few minutes, jam with Mike Huckabee and a guitarist that you probably have never met, our own Dudley Taft. Have you met Dudley before?
I met Dudley, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
And you guys are going to play a couple of songs for us. Are these songs that you played on the original records?
I don't think so. Those were really early Elvis stuff. I joined Elvis when he got out of the Army. What year was that? Whatever year that was, and I started doing his movies. So all that stuff that we did record. But most recently, A Little Less Conversation was a worldwide hit.
Yes, that's you.
It was one of the great songs that we did on the 68 comeback special. It was really great.
What's it like for you to listen to an oldies station knowing that every 15 minutes or so you're going to be on it? Is it weird, or?
You know, it's not weird, but it's weird. I mean,
yeah.
All of a sudden you hear 3, 4, 5 records in a row that you played on. Mm. And the jocks don't even know it, or whoever's, you know, dropped the needle drop. They don't even know who they're, you know, about who played on what records. That's what's so nice about this new Musicians Hall of Fame in Nashville, where some of us were just inducted. It's all about the musicians.
Tell us about the Wrecking Crew. Well, yesterday we were talking to our band members about you, by the way, and Jeff Caven, our drummer, went, "Whoa, Hal Blaine, he's going to be in the studio." And someone else said, "Hal Blaine," and Jeff was like, "He's on everything. He was part of the Wrecking Crew." And to the musicians out there, the Wrecking Crew itself, I could see, was very legendary. What was it?
Well, it all happened in the very early 60s. We came along, a bunch of guys in T-shirts and Levi's, and we started... We were doing a lot of demos, Glenn Campbell, myself, Leon Russell. There were a number of guys, Lyle Ritz, who lives in Portland now. We were doing demos for songwriters, and a lot of the demos ended up being masters and became big hits. And all of a sudden, everybody wanted us. And the older established musicians used to look at us, you know, they're wearing their blue blazers, and they used to say, these kids are going to wreck the business. And I just started automatically.
Wait a minute, you were being treated like the, like later on, like the drum machine would be treated as taking work away from other people.
Where's well, the tie? Where's the respect?
That's funny.
That was part of it, but the thing was, they hated us until they realized that we all had degrees in music, we could read music, we were composers, arrangers, conductors. We'd studied it all, you know, sight reading, sight singing. It goes on and on and on.
Well, that's why they wanted you in the studio. I do some studio work, and you want someone that walks in and you can just slightly direct them, and they know
That's that line I do. Just like I'm just like you, except at the end of the day, I make gold records.
Right. I got to ask you this.
Exactly.
Did you ever play? You must have.
Don't embarrass me now.
Well, that's what this is my job.
You already asked if you slapped anybody.
You hit things for a living. So do I. Did you ever, you have to have played on something, a hit record that you got sick of and you couldn't stand hearing it, you couldn't get it out of your head?
There was only one song that we were doing once with the Mamas and the Papas.
Uh-huh.
And I don't remember what the song was, but it was 4 o'clock in the morning. John Phillips, who had written the song, Lou Adler's producing, and we were playing it, and every time we would play it, John would do something different. And I would stop us and say, John, are you going to do that on the take? Or, because I kept track of every note that we played. I made parts. And he kept saying, I don't know, it's whatever I feel. And I'd say, well, we have to know. It was Joe Osborne, Larry Nechtel, who lives over in Yakima here. The kid that did that whole big intro on the...
You don't remember the name of the song, do you?
I don't remember the song, unless you know. I don't remember, but what happened was that he said, no, I'm going to do it this way. And I said, okay, well, we started taking it, and we got to that this way, and the band played it this way, but John went off somewhere else.
Uh-huh.
And he started screaming, okay, Blaine, I got you. This is your mistake. This time we got you. And I came over the drums after him. I was going to do a number. Lou Adler grabbed me. Everybody started grabbing him. He said, no, calm down. It was 4 o'clock in the morning. We had been rehearsing this thing for hours with this drunk. I mean, he was a great songwriter, but he lived on that Crown Royal.
So you ended up hearing that song on the radio, and you didn't like what you did. And you, or is that what it was?
You know, I have no idea. I wish I could tell you the song.
I don't know if you know this either, Hal, but you're on the number 2 record in the country right now. If you look at the Billboard charts, Frank Sinatra, the very best, is number 2 in the country, sold 100,000 copies last week.
Oh, my God.
So you're back on the Billboard charts.
Plus some more. I bought some of those stamps with his picture on them.
Yeah. What was it like to record with what some say is the, you know, the greatest singer in history?
Well, Frank was, you know, I mean, obviously it was very exciting. I had originally met Frank Sinatra over the telephone back in the 50s. When his daughter Nancy, they had an engagement party, and she was marrying a young man that I was working with, Tommy Sands, nice kid. And they had a Hollywood marriage. It was, you know, it was about 10 minutes, maybe 15 minutes. And that's when I met Frank. But what happened was, strange story, there was a local columnist, newspaper guy, who wrote this thing about Tommy and Nancy, this young, beautiful couple from Hollywood. And they're very handsome, in quotes, they're very handsome conductor, Hal Blaine. And on Hal's arm is big Mrs. Nancy Sinatra. Well, she really was the overseer of the thing. This was Frank's former wife, but it was almost like they were still married. Mm. Frank took care of them all the, you know, to the day he died. And Frank was in Germany, and he saw this article. And he called, and I remember Nancy, I mean, this was in the big, I think it was the Fontainebleau Hotel, it was magnificent, and all of a sudden, Nancy's saying, no, honey, what are you talking about? He's a kid. Don't be ridiculous. Here, you talk to him. That's how I met Frank Sinatra.
Oh, that's scary.
It was.
Oh, what would you like us to tell your parents about where to find their main parts of your body?
Hello. Well, that's a whole other story. My mother, when I was a child growing up, she would say, someday, my boy, you'll grow up, You'll meet Shirley Temple, you'll get married, and you'll be all set for life. And years later, I met Shirley Temple. I was working as a beach boy. Before I ever was a real beach boy, I was working as an actual beach boy at the Santa Monica Swim Club.
That's what a beach boy is, by the way. We don't know what beach boys are because it rains and it's cold here.
Well, a beach boy basically helps the members when they come out. They bring them umbrellas. They bring backrests.
Set up the chairs.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, they bring towels and things like that. And all the directors were going to all the movie stars. I met people like, not Buster Crabbe, but... Oh, God, what was his name? That was his
Hyman.
Name. That was his name, Buster Crabbe.
Well, Frank not only used you, but Nancy, his daughter, used you. Yeah. These boots were made for walking. That was a great song.
Well, see, after that 10-minute marriage, Nancy must have been 16 or 17. She called me and said, honey, I'm going to... And we were close. She gave me this beautiful bracelet. She said, I'm going to start singing, and I want you to be my drummer man. And I said, of course, you know, whatever you want.
And Frank called and said, first my wife, now my daughter?
And then, when the minute Frank left Capitol and started Reprise Records, I started working for Frank. Mm. And there are a lot of inside stories there.
Yeah. It was a freewheeling time, wasn't it?
It was a wonderful, wonderful time.
A lot of free love,
Bowen,
too.
Jimmy Bowen was producing everybody at Reprise, and we did all of everybody in the Rat Pack, including Regis Philbin. And we did so many people. I mean, it's hard for me to believe.
Yeah. Now, and there were a lot of pitfalls then. Obviously, drugs, which a lot of people got into. You didn't have a problem with that?
I fortunately never got into any of that.
Mm.
You know, one of the things that I learned very early in life was there is a very important word in the recording business. The word was ear. And I always thought, gee, I'd tell people the word ear, and they'd say, why is that? Because people go, ear. And before you know it, I just never got into the booze. My father had a tiny little liquor store smaller than the booth here. And my dad always said, liquor's made to be sold. I didn't like the taste of liquor, you know, I just couldn't take it. And I'd played in nightclubs as a youngster, really, for so long, getting my, basic training. And I knew that you're either going to play music or you're going to wind up in prison.
Good message today. We have Mike Huckabee is coming in next. He's working with teens to get them interested in music, which I think is a great way. It could be a way to get into drugs or a way not to get into drugs. In your case, a smart move. We're going to come back in just a few minutes, and the legendary Hal Blaine will play with the legendary Arkansas governor and the guy we know, Dudley Taft. Just a few minutes. Hang on. That's the legendary Hal Blaine playing on a little more, a little less conversation. I prefer more. Back in the studio, Governor Mike Huckabee, Hal Blaine, legendary drummer, and Dudley Taft. Dudley Taft Blues Overkill.
Yes.
Baby. We are going to have, this is an impromptu, also Pedro. Pedro, say hi. Olé. Pedro is on the percussion with strict instructions not to overshadow Hal Blaine. Yes, Mr. Shea, where am I potting this up? Right here?
CD3.
All right, quick, everybody hit one note. It's perfect. We don't have time for a real mix. Ladies and gentlemen, live in our studio, we don't have a name for this band.
The Cluster? No, I can't call it that.
The Hal Huff Dudders.
The Hal Huff Dudders. I love it.
With Spike.
You'll never hear anything like this as long as you... Hal, do you want to leave? No, you're good? Okay.
Shouldn't this be Spike and the whatevers?
No. Spike and the Hal Huff Dudders. All right, and you're going to sing? Ladies and gentlemen, here we go. Live in our studio, drummer Hal Blaine with Mike Huckabee on bass.
One, two, one.
Thank you.
ain't nothing but a hound dog crying all the time. You ain't nothing but a hound dog crying all the time. Well, you ain't never caught a rabbit and you ain't no friend of mine. But I said you was high class. Well, that was just a lie. You know they said you was high class. Well, that was just a lie. Well, you ain't never caught a rabbit and you ain't no friend of mine. You ain't nothing but a hound dog crying all the time. You ain't nothing but a hound dog crying all the time. Well, you ain't never caught a rabbit. You ain't no friend of mine. Said you was high class. Well, that was just a lie. You know they said you was high class. Well, that was just a lie. Well, you ain't never caught a rabbit. You ain't no friend of mine.
Well, thank you. That went about as smooth as the Romney campaign, didn't it? See, there's one to two. That, you had to like that.
That really hurt.
That sounded good. That sounded
all right, one more song. We got time for one more song. Dudley, what is it?
All Shook Up.
All Shook Up.
B flat? Yep. Okay. One, two, four, one, two, three.
Bless my soul, what's wrong with me? I'm itching like a man on a fuzzy tree. And my friends say I'm acting wild as a bug. I'm in the world. I'm all shook up. Hey, yeah. Oh, man. Ooh, do you say when you have such luck? I'm in the world. I'm all shook up. Hey, yeah. Well, please don't ask me what's on my mind. A little bit hurt, but I'm feeling fine. When I'm near the girl that I love best, my heart beats so it scares me to death. She touched my hand, what a thrill I've got. Her lips are like a volcano's hot. Ooh, I'm proud that she's my buttercup. I'm in love, I'm all shook up. Ooh. Hey, yeah. Tired of sleep. I am sad, sick like a leaf on a tree. There's only one cure for this body of mine. To have that girl that loves so fine. She touched my hand, what a chill I got. Her lips are like a volcano top. Ooh, I'm proud to say that she's my buttercup. In the world, I'm all shook up. Ooh, yeah, yeah. I'm all shook up.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that was pretty good. Very nice.
That was coming out of his grave, right?
Yeah. To end my campaign. Yeah.
Very well done, guys. What a pleasure to have you all here. A big thank you to, first off, Hal Blaine for doing all he does for musicians, and Arkansas Governor Presidential Candidate Mike Huckabee. Richard Belzer has spent the last couple of decades as a serious thespian, appearing in several movies, playing the role of Detective John Munch, first in Homicide and more recently in the hit NBC series Law & Order. But, you know, long before the cop shows, Richard was all about the comedy. In fact, one of his early gigs was warming up the crowd doing stand-up during Saturday Night Live's very first season. Richard Belzer, welcome back to the Bob Rivers Show. Hello.
Thanks, Bob. Nice to talk to you again.
Yeah, it's been a while. You remember, we're both Connecticut boys.
Mm-hmm.
Me, New Haven, you, Bridgeport.
Right.
And I actually read your book about being a stand-up comic, which I still remember to this day.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just amazed at the variety of all the different things that you can do.
Well, when you're old, you try everything. see how the fake modesty comes through?
That's very nice, yeah. Well, no, you have, and this character is now, he jumps from TV show to TV show like Mary Tyler Moore. It's amazing.
Well, yeah, I've been really lucky to be asked to be on other shows other than my own over the years. I did X-Files and Sesame Street and Arrested Development, and, you know, it's just... Yeah. Been like a dream for an actor.
Now, on Last Comic Standing, will you be investigating a murder there or something, or are you going to be just yourself?
Kill the audience, and yes. I'll be witness to it.
You'll be witness to him killing the audience. See, Spike,
he was killed out there.
You read the book, too. So, how are you doing personally, Richard?
Personally?
Yeah.
What do you mean? Financially? You need money?
No, I didn't mean not financially, but just like enjoying life and...
Well, I'm in my home in France in a little village with my beautiful wife and my two dogs, and I'm a very lucky person. I have a great job, and I have no right to complain. I mean, I'm in France, so...
Are you by the way, Spike, while you were saying that, he was going BS. He was mouthing BS. But I'm looking at the call screening thing.
Not
here.
Really.
You're
France.
In Bozoul, France.
Yeah, I've been here almost 20 years. I come here every year. My wife found a house here years ago and managed to get a French mortgage.
Wow.
I have to go back to the States and, you know, and pay for it.
You're so, like Johnny Depp. You feel more comfortable in France.
Well, I love the United States, but I mean, French country living is part of the year. You know, part of the year is wonderful.
Spike thinks you live in Fells Point, and he's...
I know better. Oh. I know better than that.
Yeah, no, Fells Point was cool.
I attended bar while you got right down the street while you guys filmed Homicide.
Where?
At the horse you came in on.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
So you must have seen us stagger in there.
Many, many times. You guys were the crown jewel of that neighborhood. That was a nice... Oh, that was a fun neighborhood.
So great to us in that town.
I'm amazed that you work so much and have time to leave and enjoy, you know, country living.
Well, the thing is, TV schedule, you know, I work from, like, September to May, June, and then, it's like school. I have the summer off. So I'm lucky in that I don't have to worry about, you know, getting a job over the summer. I'm, you know, one of the few actors that has a steady gig, so I'm real lucky and having a great time.
You mentioned that you live and you love two countries. Was it tough to teach your dog both languages?
Well, my dogs are both French.
Oh, they don't speak any English.
They speak any English.
They speak a little English, yeah.
Just enough. Don't go on there.
Just enough to get by.
Hey, is Last Comic Standing rigged? I know a lot of people say it's rigged.
Oh, it's not, actually. Steve Schripp and I are judges on it, and we did some of the preliminaries, and we're doing the semifinals, and we were delighted to find that there's actually some, you know, funny people still out there making the rounds. And what's great about this show is there's a lot of comics that are working out there that nobody's ever heard of or seen, and there's so few outlets on TV, so I think it's, you know, it's cool.
Right.
It's like the American Idol of comedy, but we're not mean, because, you know, it's hard enough to do stand-up, so.
Yeah, we've met some pretty good people out of there. All right, we only have a little limited time. I want to ask you a couple of things.
Sure.
What motivated you to throw your beret in the ring for Barack Obama?
Well, I had given up on politics for a long time. You know, most of my heroes had their heads blown off, and it's very hard to invest in someone, but I genuinely believe that... If he's elected, that it'll be great for not only for us but for the world. I think he is America. He's a mixed race guy. He brought himself up by his bootstraps. He's incredibly smart, and he seems to be the real deal. And most of his money comes from $200 or less. Most of his donors, so he's not owned by these oil companies. So I think it's very, very promising, and I'll do all I can to help him.
All right. I'm all over the board here with stuff about you. UFOs, JFK, and Elvis. Which
book I wrote about 10 years ago.
Right. Which do you think are more alive and kicking right now?
Of those three?
Yeah.
Well, the Elvis thing is obviously a joke.
Okay.
Because, you know, whenever you mention JFK or UFOs, they say, yeah, and Elvis is still alive. It's just a way of marginalizing it. But, no, I mean, you don't have to make anything up. There's... Hi, baby. It's my dog. There's a lot of things in the public domain that you could find on the internet that are irrefutably true, that have been released by researchers and the government, and just have to be diligent and a little crazy like me, and you know, have the time to do it. But it's a crazy world out there, and there's, you know, you don't need fiction.
So the UFOs, in other words, of those three, the UFOs, we're probably being watched. We're probably under...
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if they're from another planet or if they're from another dimension or if they're our own technology, or, but clearly something's going on that most countries in the world are interested in and have extensive files on. And because of video cameras and the camcorders, there's an amazing amount of incredible footage now that anybody can see, so it's not as kooky as you might think.
Richard Belzer in Bozoul, France. Thank you, Richard.
Great talking to you guys.
Be well.
Take care.